This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on March the 22nd, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
I'd like to convene the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, March 22nd, 2007. The first item on our agenda is the correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the minutes of the Federal Election Commission's open meeting of Thursday,
March 8th,
2007, as set forth in Agenda Document 0720.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you can record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. The second item on our agenda is the Draft Advisory Opinion 2007-1, Senator Claire McCaskill. Mr. Vice Chairman, I note we have a late submitted agenda document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider the Draft Advisory Opinion set forth in Agenda Document 0719.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have from the General Counsel's Office, Stacey Shin and Dwayne Pugh. Ms. Shin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. The draft advisory opinion before you responds to a request on behalf of Senator McCaskill and McCaskill for Auditor. Prior to her election to the United States Senate in 2006, Senator McCaskill was a candidate for governor and state auditor. McCaskill for Auditor Committee was established under Missouri law in preparation for her re-election campaign for state auditor. The requesters ask whether they may raise funds in accordance with Missouri law to retire the committee's debts remaining from these state campaigns, including debt owed to Senator McCaskill. The draft concludes that McCaskill for Auditor and its agents may raise funds in accordance with Missouri state law for the sole purpose of retiring the committee's debt that remains from these previous state candidacies. In the alternative, the requesters may raise federally permissible funds. The draft also concludes that solicitations referring to Senator McCaskill are permitted under the Act so long as such solicitations comply with Missouri law and refer only to Senator McCaskill and other candidates for the same state offices. In addition, the Act's general restrictions on state candidates do not apply to this situation because the conduct is governed by a more specific provision of the Act pertaining to a federal office holder who was previously a state candidate. And finally, the draft does not reach the requester's question concerning an exemption under the Commission's coordinated communications regulations, because whereas here the candidate and her agents are paying for the communications, the payment prong is not satisfied and the coordinated communication definition is inapplicable. We have not received any comments on the draft advisory opinion, and I will be happy to address any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any comments from the Commissioner? Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the Draft Advisory Opinion 2007-1.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the issue? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. The next four items on our agenda all involve reforms to this agency's practices and procedures. Two of them are issues of longstanding here at the agency. One involves the updating of our ethics rules, and the second is and it changes to our administrative fines program. And two of those items were part of the reforms we began last year, and we will be bringing those to completion here, that being both the sua sponte policy and the embezzlement policy. And before we moved on to the substance, I did want to take a moment to express my thanks and appreciation to our staff, who has been working very, very hard to get all of this work done, and also to the commissioners. I can look through these documents and see the handiwork of everyone at this table. And in some cases, a lot of work went into this on the part of commissioners trying to think through how best to achieve these goals. And so I think that it is just very heartening that we have been able to achieve so much, or I think we anticipate we will achieve so much today, and that the effects of these changes are immediate. Certainly we have had a number this year already of expedited advisory opinions that, you know, was a process that we began last year. It was only the 8th of March that we voted in a procedure to begin pre-probable cause hearings. Some 2 weeks later, we've now held our first. And so the changes to the operation of this agency are occurring now, we are seeing the effects now. And I wanted to thank everybody for the hard work that went into making this all possible. With that, I would like to move to the first of the items, which is the draft notice of proposed rulemaking on standards of conduct. Mr. Vice Chairman, I note again we have a late submitted document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda document 0726.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have Robert Knopf, Stacey Shin, and Dwayne Pugh from the General Counsel's Office. Mr. Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda document 0726 is a draft notice of proposed rulemaking on standards of conduct for commissioners and commission employees. The proposed rules would update the commission's regulations to reflect statutory changes to the Ethics in Government Act and the Hatch Act since the commission's standards of conduct were originally promulgated. The proposed rules would conform the Commission's ethics rules to regulations issued by the Office of Government Ethics and the Office of Personnel Management. The proposed changes to the Commission's standards of conduct can be divided into three general categories. The first category is current regulations that the Commission proposes to delete because they are supplanted by OGE and OPM regulations. The second category is current regulations that the Commission proposes to retain, either because they are informational or procedural in nature, or because they are based on statutory authority other than the Ethics in Government Act or the Hatch Act. And the third category is new regulations that would supplement OGE's ethics regulations and be issued with OGE's approval. Most notable of these is one on outside activities of commission employees. Under the proposed rule, commission employees would be required to obtain prior approval in order to engage in outside activities where the services that they would provide are related to the employee's official duties or involve the use of the same specialized skills or educational background as the employee uses in performing official duties. One final point I'd like to make is that all of the proposed rule in the draft NPRM must be reviewed and approved by the Office of Government Ethics prior to being published in the Federal Register and put out for public comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Thank you. Any comments or discussion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am incredibly gratified to have this document in front of us because it started back when I was chair, and we had to sideline it because we had a number of other more pressing rulemaking projects, and I'm very glad that we're finally able to get back to it. In a sense, it's a housekeeping matter because the commission has, by longstanding practice, followed the rules that are issued by the Office of Government Ethics, and so we're not really changing a lot in the way we do business here. But I think it's important that we have rules that are on their face in compliance with the rules that everybody else in the government follows. Particularly important to me as an old ethics lawyer to make sure that our rules were exactly as they ought to be, and I am very pleased that we are finally in a position to get this rulemaking out the door, and I appreciate very much the many hours of work that went into this document by Mr. Knopf and Mr. Pugh and all the work that went into back and forth with the Office of Government Ethics, and I hope that this will now smoothly go towards agreement with the Office of Government Ethics and a final rule.
Very good. Other comments? Question? A motion, maybe? Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of Agenda Document 07-26.
Commissioner Weintraub is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Madam Secretary, Commissioner Weintraub's motion is adopted by a vote of 5-0. The next item on our agenda involves a draft final rules on the best efforts in the administrative fines challenges. Mr. Vice Chairman, we again have a late submitted document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda document 0724.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have Margaret Pearl and Dwayne Pugh from the General Counsel's Office. Ms. Pearl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 0724 is a draft final rule and explanation and justification for the best efforts in administrative fines challenges rulemaking. The draft final rule revises the rules governing permissible defenses available to administrative fine respondents and commission final determination in administrative fine matters. Specifically, the draft final rule revises Part 111 in four ways. First, clarifying the scope of the factual errors defense in Section 111.35(b)(1). Second, replacing the previous extraordinary circumstances defense with a new best efforts defense in Section 111.35(b)(3). Third, clarifying when the Commission finds no violation under Section 111.37(b). And finally, explaining that the Commission's statement of reasons will usually consist of the reviewing officer's recommendations as adopted by the Commission under Section 111.37(d). These changes are consistent with the District Court's holding in Lovely v. FEC, which focused on the application of the Act's best efforts provision at 2 U.S.C. 432I. The draft final rule revising Section 111.35 to incorporate a defense in the administrative fines program for political committees that demonstrate they use their best efforts to file timely. The best efforts defense is defined as a two-part test where a respondent must demonstrate that the respondent was prevented from filing in a timely manner by reasonably unforeseen circumstances that were beyond the control of the respondent, and that the respondent filed the report in question no later than 24 hours after the end of the circumstances preventing the timely filing. The draft final rule also includes examples of circumstances that will and will not be considered by the Commission to be reasonably unforeseen and beyond the control of the respondent under the best efforts defense. Finally, the draft final rule revises Section 111.37 to make clear that the statement of reasons for the Commission's final determination in administrative fine matters consists of the reasons provided by the reviewing officer for the reviewing officer recommendation, unless otherwise indicated by the Commission. I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Pearl. Any questions or discussions? I mean, for my part, I thought this was helpful. It certainly addresses an issue that was raised by the court in 2004. And while not enormous significance, it was important and worthy of us making some amendments to our rules in accordance. It also provided, I think, as an opportunity to rephrase the rule somewhat to make it somewhat clearer in its operation and application. And so I appreciate the work that was done in preparing this document. Any other comments? Suggestions? Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to support the document. I'm a little concerned about some of the language that is not as clear as it could be. But I recognize that it's a compromise and everybody puts their two cents in and we try and find some place to agree in the middle and never let it be said that I wasn't willing to compromise on the small stuff. So I hope that we are not creating any ambiguities that are going to run us into trouble down the road in continuing to administer what has been an extremely successful program for the Commission that's helped in achieving better compliance with the disclosure rules. And since I overall support what we're doing in this document, I will support the draft.
Very good. Other comments or suggestions? Okay. Maybe a motion would be in order. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we approve the final rule and explanation and justification for best efforts in administrative fine challenges as set forth in Agenda Document 0724.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion is adopted by a vote of 5-0. Thank you, Ms. Pearl.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is a policy regarding the self-reporting of campaign finance violations, which also travels under the name of sua sponte submissions. I realized in preparing for today that we would have almost endless motions to suspend our rule for late submitted documents, and I was thinking about how that would appear, and I think the truth of the matter is that it only reflects that we've been working very hard, even this week, in trying to finalize these documents. So that said, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider agenda document 0725.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. On this matter, we have Mr. Mark Schonkweiler and Rhonda Bosdam from the General Counsel's Office. Oh, I'm sorry. April Sands as well. I apologize. My sheet is out of date here. I did not notice. Ms. Sands.
Thank you. Welcome. Good morning. Before you is a policy statement regarding self-reporting of campaign finance violations or sua sponte submissions. Self-reporting of violations typically allows respondents to resolve their civil liability in a manner which has the potential to reduce the investigative burden on both the commission and themselves, demonstrate their acceptance of organizational or personal responsibility and commitment to internal compliance, and conclude their involvement in the commission's enforcement process on an expedited basis. This policy statement clarifies the Commission's policies and procedures regarding self-reported violations of the Act and Commission regulations and announces the availability of a new fast-track resolution procedure that will be available under certain conditions. The Commission seeks to provide appropriate incentives for respondents to cooperate and assume responsibility for their actions. As a result, the proposal also outlines the criteria the Commission will use when considering whether to reduce the civil penalty that is sought from a respondent. The Office of General Counsel brings this policy statement forward, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Very good. Thank you. Any discussion? Okay. I mean, from my perspective, I think that this is a real step forward. There is no doubt that voluntary compliance with the law is the cornerstone of the operation of this agency. We have only about 370 people working here. They are regulating about 9,000 political committees that raise and spend about $4 billion in an election cycle, and they file about 100,000 reports with us in that same election cycle. So there's no doubt that voluntary compliance is essential to compliance with the law. It is also, I think, true that for many years there was a sense in the community that the worst penalties were reserved for those who came in and voluntarily confessed their violations to this agency, and that there has been and that was really has become really out of step to the degree that was true is really out of step with the legal environment that exists, especially in the year after the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley. And so there have been a number of efforts to on the part of this agency to try and indicate to those that are regulated by it that voluntary compliance and to the degree that violations are found, the voluntary presentation of violations to this agency is the appropriate way to go. And I think that this policy is a very concrete manifestation of that. And so I think it is a good and useful step forward. Other comments? Discussions? Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to echo your comments. I'm very enthusiastic about this policy. I'm glad we were able to bring it forward on this crowded agenda. You're quite the slave driver, Mr. Chairman. You've got us hopping around here. But I do think it's very important to encourage compliance and to give people some solid incentives so that when they discover that they may have inadvertently broken the law, and virtually all of the things that we see, the vast, vast majority are inadvertent violations, that they have some incentives to come forward and try and get right with the law. And I think it's appropriate for us to do that, and I strongly support this.
Good. Other comments? Discussions? Seeing none, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the policy statement regarding self-reporting of campaign finance violations as set forth in Agenda Document 0725.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? And the Vice Chairman's motion passes by a vote of 5-0. Thank you very much, Ms. Sands. The next item on our agenda involves the Commission's policy statement regarding internal controls. And we have both Mr. Stoltz from the Audit Division and Ms. Nazanet from the Staff Director's Office. Mr. Stoltz, would you like to begin?
I will. Good morning. And as the Commission knows, we have been seeing over the last couple of election cycles what appears to be a marked increase of incidences where committee staff are embezzling funds from their employers. We also note that in many cases, internal accounting controls that would be probably more common in the business world are not often in place in the political world. So a while back, it was suggested that perhaps we prepare a piece that would provide committees some advice about instituting some controls to protect themselves. And out of that also came a suggestion that a safe harbor policy be developed, which would specify minimum controls that if they were in fact in place and an embezzlement did occur, the commission would not hold the committee liable for the misreporting that often accompanies these. Those two documents are before you today. The first is entitled Safe Harbor. The second is Internal Controls and Political Committees. They were put out on the Commission's website for comment. We received 10 separate comments, some of them signed by multiple commenters. They were mostly supportive of the effort. There were several people who particularly liked the safe harbor concept. There were those who contend that political committees are too small, they can't be expected to use the same sorts of controls and checks and balances that businesses do. However, as the chairman noted on the last issue, the amount of money running through the political process these days is huge and growing. And I think as the business grows, some of the business practices are going to need to grow with it. However, nothing in these documents requires anybody to do anything. They are free to use whatever pieces of it they care to use, to decide against any of it they care to decide against. It's simply advice, at least for the Internal Control and Political Committee document. The Safe Harbor document likewise doesn't require anybody to do anything, but it does provide committees an opportunity to protect themselves should something happen. The comments also frequently suggested that these controls be flexible, that no one set was going to work for everybody, and that's certainly true. No one set works for every business, no one set works for every government agency, and no one set is going to work for every political committee. We have tried to make it clear in the documents that flexibility is recognized, the need for it is recognized, and that committees are free to set it up however best suits their operation. There are a number of miscellaneous comments concerning whether this needed to be a regulation. Again, it's advice, and it's a safe harbor. Nobody's required to do anything. There are a number of other small suggestions that were made. I will say we got a number of very constructive suggestions, and many of them have been incorporated in the final version of the document, and certainly appreciate the thought that went into it by all of the commenters. The Safe Harbor document, which begins on the fourth page of the agenda document, there has been a suggestion by the Office of General Counsel that it include at the end a standard policy statement disclaimer that appears on the end of all of our policy statements, and I would certainly recommend that we include that. Council will also, I think, assist in reformatting this particular piece to be published in the Federal Register. On the Internal Controls and Political Committees document, I understand that Commissioner Von Spakovsky has a suggestion for paragraph 2, which I would be more than happy to accept. It is in the second paragraph of paragraph 2, or second sentence of paragraph 2, which now reads, "To that end, the Commission has prepared the following discussion to assist committees in protecting their assets and complying with the requirements of the FECA." And as amended would read, "To that end, the Commission has prepared the following best practice recommendations, period. These are not mandatory, but are intended to assist committees in protecting their assets and complying with the requirements of the FECA." With that, I will take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stoltz. I think that was a very clear and helpful discussion of the document before us, and I would like to just reinforce one of your comments, which, you know, and it was true in the Susponte policy as well, of how much we appreciate public comment. It is not simply a form or a ritual that we have to go through. We've gotten a number of these matters. Very, very helpful comment from the outside. I know that it is, in some cases, time-consuming, and in other cases, expensive for people to do that. And I think both in this document and in the sua sponte document, you can see instances where it actually changes outcomes, where people with different perspectives and different, with a different understanding of how these regulations or rules or policies will impact different kinds of organizations, provide insight into the consequences of the language we choose. And I think that that is enormously helpful to us, and we really appreciate it, and especially given an understanding on my part, and I think a number of the Commission's parts, that can be expensive, and it's a voluntary decision on the part of individuals or organizations to do that, and we do appreciate those. When people do it. Other Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, I want to pick up on that and say we've gone through a lot of policies. All of these are important, but this one is, I think, particularly important because this was generated by several of the commissioners, and the reason for it was that we had a number of cases in the past year where we were fining political committees who had misreported, and the misreporting was due to the fact that, and they didn't realize this, some of their employees were embezzling funds. And naturally, I mean, many of the political committees were frankly shocked, and they thought it was unfair for us to be fining them. Now, in all of those cases, the fines that we put on the people who actually embezzled the funds were, of course, much larger, and the fines that were imposed on the political committees were considerably lessened from what they would have been. But the reason that in some of these cases they were fined was because when we went in and looked at the cases, we found that these committees had not put in very basic financial controls that might have prevented the embezzlement. But it was tough. Because we don't have a policy on this, it was frankly hard, I think, for some of these committees to understand that and understand why it was that they were being fined. And so what we're doing here is we're setting out a policy, and the safe harbor is particularly important, because what it says to these committees is if you put in place these minimum financial safeguards, then even if they don't work and someone still embezzles funds from you, we're not going to fine you for having misreported funds because you did what you needed to do to try to protect yourself from this, and you're not then responsible for the fact that someone still broke the law and embezzled funds for you. And so all these committees now, you know, not only have a guide to what they need to do to prevent this, but I think now they will be able to understand, if they don't do this, why it is that they're getting fined, despite the fact that they were victims of what is basically criminal activity.
Thank you. Other comments? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank Mr. Stoltz for his hard work in doing this and for his responsiveness to my request, which may have been one of the things that prompted getting this before us. To emphasize, as Joe has and my colleagues, that these are voluntary steps, but they're steps meant to protect the political committees and the political committees' donors. And let me say, I have been reluctant all along in fining committees that have been victims of embezzlement. And generally speaking, organizations that are victims of employees' misconduct are held responsible by other civil enforcement agencies, financial regulatory agencies, such as those regulating banks, publicly traded corporations, for instance, only where the company itself has somehow failed in its duty to reasonably supervise its employees. And so I thought it was important for us to lay out, in essence, what we thought the duties of the campaign committees were in that regard if we were going to continue down this road. That said, let me say that, and I know there's concern on the part of some of the people who commented about, gee, this is just too tough for political committees to do. And if that's their view, they're free to continue to pursue that. I don't really share it. And some of the internal control weaknesses that we've seen are sort of beyond explanation or beyond excuse. In one case that we have in-house now, it was an embezzlement by an employee, which the employee was able to continue in a pattern over a period of 4 or 5 years, because for a period of 4 years or more, no one reconciled the committee's bank statements to its FEC reports. Now, if committees are simply unwilling to do that and simply want to hand something off to a single employee for 4 or 5 years and have nobody ever look over that employee's shoulder, then I think we've gotten beyond the point where we can say, well, gee, this committee was a victim, because what happened in that circumstance is the committee set up circumstances which allowed itself to become a victim. And that's the sort of circumstance that leads me to conclude, if that's what's going on, that the committee is at least in part responsible for the misreporting that occurred, because they hadn't bothered to look at their internal books for that long period of time. The second element is how often this is happening. This is not once every few year thing, but at least in recent times has been several times every election cycle. In a couple of cases, it has been, we had a candidate in New Hampshire a couple of years ago who pulled out of the race following a series of embezzlements. We've had some others where this may well have influenced the outcome of the race. And so for the candidate's own protection, I would assume they would want to do some of this. And then on the particulars of the proposal, I have discussed with my colleagues and want to put out for further discussion today the dual signature requirement. And let me note first that we've had 3 or 4 cases very recently which involved a series of embezzlements by an employee over a period of time, and in all of those cases the embezzlements have been relatively small amounts. In fact, interestingly, in several of those cases amounts around $1,000 per transaction. In my view, for that reason, if the two signature requirement is to have a value, we ought to go ahead and use $1,000 threshold. I recognize that the flexible threshold, the 0.5% of anticipated annual disbursements, is in response to some of the comments, and I'm concerned about that, both because I think it allows or it moves that threshold for many committees well above the level at which we have had demonstrated problems in the past. And that is to say, for $1 million annual committee, which would hardly be unusual these days, the threshold requirement would be $5,000. And yet we've seen the problem seems to be at amounts much lower than that. Secondly, because I think a straight dollar threshold is simply easier to administer. If a committee is looking and saying what their anticipated annual disbursements are, I'm not sure how they're going to know with any certainty. They're not going to know with any certainty how much that amount is. And while I agree as to the overall point about flexibility and about controls having to correspond to the committee's size and sophistication, I don't think a standard of this sort is particularly helpful, especially in the context of a safe harbor where I don't want to have to go back and start looking at their annual requirements and how they administered their dual signature requirements. So I would be more comfortable with a straight $1,000 threshold than with this flexible provision. I'd also note that understand that some of the commenters are concerned that this would involve routine payroll checks, rent payments, and so on like that. I actually assume that for the larger committees, they're going to have an easier time complying with the two-signature requirement because they're actually going to have staffs out there available to do this sort of thing. And so I'm not sure that it is, in effect, going to be a more significant burden for the larger committees. But I also note that this is a policy statement, and therefore it would be relatively easy to adjust. If after some relatively short period this is simply too complex to comply with, it would be a lot easier than a regulation to come back and adjust that threshold. And in particular, if, for instance, payroll checks need some kind of special treatment, we could come back and take a look at that at some point in the future.
Okay. Thank you very much. Comments on the Vice Chairman's thoughts on this? Silence is acquiescence in some environments. I think that the I think all of you raise a number of good points. This certainly, I think, my impression was added in response to the comments, and one of the things that we have obviously been struggling with here is to try and make sure that we set forth in this safe harbor environment things which will actually serve as safeguards to reduce the risk of embezzlement, things that seem like the minimal protections that need to be in place, and yet also choose ones that are in fact practical and workable. And I think Mr. Stoltz has done and his staff have done an excellent job in sort of a longer and more detailed document talking about the different kinds of factors that different kinds of committees can take into consideration in deciding what sort of controls they put in place. Any other thoughts on this? Commissioner Vospikowski.
I have a question for Mr. Stoltz, if I may. How did you come up with the recommendation for $1,000 as being the floor? I mean, is this based on, as the Vice Chairman mentioned, some of the embezzlement cases we had and the average size of the checks that were, the amounts that were stolen, or is this also based on in your auditing experience, looking at the kind of disbursements and expenditures that these various committees make and the average size of the kind of disbursements that they make?
Originally, it was in the original document, it was used as an example. And, $1,000 is on the low end, I think. As Commissioner Mason says, in a lot of cases, these folks write themselves fairly large numbers of modest sized checks, and so it's a combination of a number of factors. In hearing some of the comments, I think the concern was if we want people to adopt this, then we need to set it in some way where it is not administratively unattractive. And so this was an attempt to sort of walk the line between getting it down far enough that it would be effective, but not too low so that it becomes administratively unattractive for people to do it. I don't think there is one particularly right answer to it. Wherever we decide to set it is fine.
It is a difficult balance, yes. Vice Chairman Mason.
I just want to discuss on the authorized in writing part, Joe, whether you interpret that, for instance, in the case of payroll disbursements to allow some sort of system that would authorize those to go out on a routine basis with a single signature pursuant to limitations laid out in a memorandum of some sort.
I think that would make sense, particularly in payroll for larger committees, because that's, you know, particularly you start looking at people like presidential campaigns who may have a payroll with well in excess of 100 people on them. It could be a bit of a burden.
And presumably the same might be true for routine and predictable disbursements, such as a rent payment, which is going to come due every month. It's going to be a certain amount. That a memorandum authorizing that payment of that amount to be issued each month on a single signature would suffice for that and for other similar routine recurring payments.
I would think that makes sense, particularly in of course with controls like this, it's a system and it has to work together. Particularly if we are also in a situation where somebody other than the people writing checks are also going through the bank statements and doing the reconciliation, which means that if there are two rent payments that month and one of them is made payable to somebody else, it's not going to go undetected for more than a very short period of time.
Okay. Mr. Vice Chairman?
I don't want to cut off other discussion or questions, but if there isn't any, I would move adoption of the document, except that we would, in the internal control section, after the $1,000, we would delete the words or 0.5% of anticipated annual disbursements. That we would add the disclaimer statement, the normal disclaimer statement as recommended by the Office of General Counsel. The amendment is previously outlined, recommended by Commissioner Von Spakovsky, and authorize the Office of General Counsel to make any necessary formatting or technical or other changes appropriate to publication.
Mr. Stoltz?
I think we would probably also want to conform the political committees and internal controls document on the 0.5%. I don't think we want two different things in the different places. So
yes,
I'll make the same change there.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Stoltz. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call the question. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Thank you very much, Mr. Stoltz. We appreciate your efforts in this. The next item on our agenda is a report on the of the Audit Division on the Clerk for President, Inc. We have a number of staff here. We have Leroy Clay, Alex Bonowitz, and Joe Stoltz from the Audit Division of the Staff Director's Office. We also have Margaret Foreman and Lorenzo Holloway of the General Counsel's Office. Mr. Calvert is here as well, I see, today. I believe we are going to start with Mr. Bonowitz.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman. The report of the Audit Division on Clerk for President presents six findings. The issues and findings 1, 4, 5, and 6 are straightforward. However, finding 2 discusses excessive in-kind contributions of $9,315 arising from air charters. That amount should be paid to the U.S. Treasury. Finding 3, receipt of contributions that exceed limits, discusses $247,911 in excessive contributions, which amount should also be paid to the U.S. Treasury. We are prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, very good. Mr. Bonowitz. Any questions, comments, discussion? It's a sign you've done a great job, Mr. Bonowitz. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you.
I move approval of the report of the Audit Division on Clerk for President, Inc. as set forth in Agenda Document 0723.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Excellent work, staff. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. The next item on our agenda is the final audit report in Bush Cheney 04, Inc., the General Committee, and Bush Cheney 04, the Compliance Committee. We have from the Audit Division, Rhonda Gillingwater, Mr. Mr. Bonowitz, as well as Mr. Stoltz, and Delaney Painter and Lorenzo Holloway from the General Counsel's Office. I understand, Mr. Bonowitz, you would like to begin again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to say Rhonda Gillingwater was unavailable today and
testifies.
Mr. Esmosmo is here as the lead. Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The report of the Audit Division on Bush-Cheney 04, Inc., and the Bush-Cheney 04 Compliance Committee, Inc., presents two findings. The first discusses in-kind contributions of about $70,000 arising from air charter providers. These were resolved by documentation provided by the committee indicating the reimbursement for these flights were proper. The second finding, expenditure limitation, indicates that Bush-Cheney 04 has not exceeded the limitation. Again, we're prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any discussion, comments? Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the staff for all the hard work they put into what I think was a challenging audit, both for the auditors and the lawyers. There's nothing like a good audit with some juicy allocation issues to get your blood boiling. The commission is, as always, has been working very hard of late to try to reach consensus and to try and come together many times unanimously. I think today everything we did was unanimous, but we've also done many other issues which were more complicated and controversial than the ones that we've handled today that were also unanimous. But sometimes we can't get there. We just have a disagreement. We had a disagreement on this audit, and it was a doozy. Now, it's, as I said, audits and allocations aren't very sexy. I'll try and put this in plain English. The public financing system is premised on a bargain. Candidate gets $75 million, in this case, number changes from one cycle to the next, from the taxpayers. And in return, the candidate promises not to spend beyond that amount. Now, assuming that the candidate has the support of his or her party, they get a little bit of extra to play around with through the coordinated party spending limit, which in this case, in this election year, was $16 million. But that's it. It's all the money the candidate's supposed to be spending. And if they spend more than that, under the if they take more than that, and if they spend more than that under the law and the rules, they have to repay the Treasury the excess. Bush-Cheney 04 took the $75 million from the taxpayers, and then they broke the bargain. They spent the $75 and the $16 with that they were perfectly legally entitled to spend, along with their party committee. But then they continued to coordinate with the Republican Party to spend on an ad campaign that was worth about $81 million, and half of that was paid by the party. So when you take the 81 plus the commissions that the party paid, that was about a $42 million excessive contribution from the RNC, the Republican National Committee, to Bush-Cheney 04. And I don't fault the staff in the slightest for a report that says that they didn't reach the expenditure limit, because that was based on a vote that the commission took. And so the staff didn't really have any choice at that point. But it's important to note that when we analyzed the spending limit, when we analyzed the underlying allocation of funds for those, what came to be called the hybrid ads, the commission split 3-3. There weren't four votes to say that the Bush committee had violated the law. But there also weren't four votes to say they complied with it. We just couldn't decide, and in a case like that where we split and there aren't four votes for a violation, that means there's no violation under the law, and the staff drew the logical conclusion from that. Now, these ads that were at issue specifically named the president, or in the case of the negative ads, his opponent, Senator Kerry. And then there were some vague references to others, leaders in Congress, liberals in Congress, sometimes allies. And based on that, the party committee said, well, we're getting half the value out of these ads, so we get to pay for half of the ads. But The commission has never before allowed that kind of an allocation with such a vague reference to other people. And I think if we did allow it, then basically what we're saying is that put aside the statutory contribution limits, put aside the coordinated contribution limits, because the party is going to always be able to pay for half the value of the candidate's ads, just because they say, well, we think we're going to get some benefit out of it. And why does it matter? It matters because there are caps. There are, when you take the public funding, you accept a cap on how much money you're going to spend. And it's separately in the coordinated spending provision, 441AD, there's a limit on how much money the party can spend in coordination with its candidate on things like these ads, which the candidate had control over and got to direct exactly how the message was going to come out. Now, why would they think that they could do this? Well, it's been raised that we had other regulations on the books that were sort of similar that might give them reason to believe that they could get away with this. Those regulations are the phone bank regulations that the commission adopted, ironically, in the wake of the audit of the Bush 2000 committee, which, in combination with some state party committees, paid for some phone banks. And the phone bank said, get out and vote for George Bush and the great Republican team. And they said, well, looks to us like the Republican parties and their candidates are getting three-quarters of the value of those phone banks, and the president's only getting one-quarter of the value. I don't know what that was.
There's construction work going on in the building. I assume that that's what caused that.
We'll make that assumption. And when we looked at the audits in the 2000, out of the 2000 race, I thought that was a completely untenable hypothesis, that the named candidate only got one-quarter of the benefit of this communication, and people who were never named got three-quarters of the benefit. But there again, there weren't four votes to find a violation. There was about $500,000 on the table. At that time, we thought that was a lot of money. And so it went forward with a finding that that was not a violation. And subsequently, we adopted these phone bank regulations because there was a general sense that, you know, that wasn't a good result. And in the phone bank regulations, the commission adopted a rule that for phone banks, and only for phone banks, the party that made reference to a particular candidate and made reference to the party could pay for 50% and the candidate could pay for 50%. And at the time, I wasn't that wild about that formula either, but it was certainly better than allowing 75-25. But because of my concern that it wasn't really a great rule, I was, at my behest, there was language inserted in the explanation and justification that said, this is only for phone banks. We're not dealing with other forms of communications, which may raise other issues. And I took some comfort from the fact that we were at least limiting this 50-50 split rule to the phone bank context. And what it seems to me the Bush campaign did was to, you know, look at that limitation and say, well, Commissioner, you might have thought you were limiting it to the phone bank context, but we're just going to ignore that limitation and go ahead and use it in other contexts because it suits our purpose to do so. Now, later, after this, long after the phone bank regulations and after the 2004 election, the Commission was confronted last year with an AO, 2006-11, in which we looked at mass mailings and what would be the appropriate allocation of certain mass mailings that contained communications that mentioned again a federal candidate and the great Democratic team. In that case, it came from the D side of the aisle. And how should they go about allocating the costs of such a communication? And what the Commission said was, well, clearly, the candidate who's named is getting the biggest bang for the buck out of that. So at a minimum, that candidate has to pay 50%. After that, we'll take a look at what the ad looks like, what the mass mailing looks like, and see whether it's appropriate, whether there's some discernible benefit to other persons, to other members of the Democratic Party that would justify the party assuming some portion of the other 50%. But the 50% was just a floor. It was not a flat 50% allocation, 50-50 rule. And when we looked at this audit, the 2004 audit, we considered whether we ought to apply that rule, even though it had been put into effect after the 2004 election. It was suggested that maybe we should give the Bush campaign the benefit of that. Since the commission had come to that conclusion that that was appropriate, we should give them the benefit of that. And a motion was made that we should return the audit to our staff so that they could make that determination, so they could look at it and say, okay, if the Bush campaign pays 50%, what is the discernible benefit to anybody else from these ads, and what would be the appropriate allocation of this? And I thought that was actually a fairly generous offer, since this rule wasn't even in effect. It was new in 2006 that the commission was willing to allow this kind of allocation in these circumstances. And we didn't get four votes for that either, to go back and do that analysis. And I think that the reason that we didn't get four votes to do that analysis is that if you go back and look at the ads, the 50-50 allocation doesn't stand. If you go back and look at the vague references that are in these ads to liberals and leaders and allies, that there is minimal discernible benefit to any candidate other than the president who is named in these ads, or in some ads, the negative ads, so they name Senator Kerry. And I think that this is important, because, again, there are caps on how much money can be spent. So unless there's some specific permission, some specific provision that allows more money to be spent in combination with this candidate, it's all in violation. So I voted that the allocation was impermissible, and I voted that the expenditure cap was breached. I believe that Bush Cheney 04 owes the taxpayers a $42 million repayment. Now, that's not in this report because there aren't four votes for that. So, consistent with all of these positions, I'm going to vote against the audit report. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Other comments, questions, discussions? Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try not to go on too long, but I think some response is in order. I first start off by acknowledging that the issue raised by Commissioner Weintraub is a debatable legal issue. So there were two sides to that, and I recognize that, and I think my colleagues do as well. Let me start off. I perhaps bored my colleagues before with a reference to a curious little entry in Sapphire's Political Dictionary. You can get the book and look it up under Jaime's Ferry Boat. It's interesting to me, both because the details and the particulars of the story are entertaining, but more pertinently, because this occurred during the Roosevelt administration, which is to say that it occurred before the existence of the Federal Election Campaign Act, and therefore is illustrative to me anyway of what parties' historical interests in the top of the ticket are, and their relationship of the top of the ticket to other candidates, and how parties conducted their business when there wasn't a federal statute out there that told them they couldn't do one thing or another, or in this case, that potentially gave them an incentive to alter their behavior because of these spending limits out there. And the gist of the story is that a local candidate in New York under the operation of the party machine was required to make a contribution to the party. So sort of like members of Congress today are expected to send their dues in to the relevant House and Senate committee, the local candidates were expected to fund the party campaign. And a local candidate in this instance did so, and then went and complained to the Brooklyn party boss that he'd paid up his share and that none of the campaign literature and none of the signs had his name on them. And the party boss went on to explain in rather colorful terms that Roosevelt was the tugboat, the Staten Island ferry, who was going to pull in all of the other candidates of the party. So what I take from that is that for a long time in American history, the parties in fact viewed the top of the ticket, and I think it's reflected in the coattail exemption and the FICA even, as having a very material effect on down-ballot candidates. And so in that context, the argument that advertising that focuses on the presidential candidate is of value to all of the candidates of that party is, to me, entirely reasonable. Now, how we ought to deal with that in the context of our regulations and public financing and so on, I think, is open to some wide variety of argument. But I think the fundamental idea that somehow if it just focuses on the presidential candidate, that it doesn't legitimately help other candidates of the party is not a correct one. I recognize Commissioner Weintraub's recitation of the history and the limitation of our rule 4 years ago or so to phone banks. The problem, I think, is that it sort of cuts both ways. I mean, on the one hand, we said, well, this just applies to phone banks, but on the other hand, we said other medium may have other factors present there. And so we left some vagueness, which the Bush Committee took advantage of, if you want to put it that way. But what we said was other media may have other considerations, and that's where we are now. What we have agreed, and I would say that the discussion in the 2004 audit, discussion in this audit, the advisory opinion, even though it came later, all come to the conclusion that this sort of activity, at least in some circumstances, is allocable. And so the real argument was over what percentage ought to apply or what methodology ought to apply to determine that and what particular types of ads are we going to have a specific content requirement. I think those are all fair questions, and we have agreed to initiate a rulemaking, which I think we're going to be doing very soon, to define that for the next election cycle. And in my view, there are a lot of issues in that area that we appropriately can resolve. But given that I believe these ads were appropriately allocable, and given the combination of guidance we'd had out there and lack of guidance, I did not think the decision to allocate these at 50% was unreasonable. And that's why I came to the conclusion I did in the audit. I know that Commissioner Weintraub, and I think some of my other colleagues feel very strongly about this issue. I appreciate that. But I would note that it has been the consistent practice of the Commission not to include findings in the audit that didn't have four votes. And that was what was done here, so there's really no legal or procedural difference in this finding and in many other findings where we've had 3-3 splits down through the years. Commissioner obviously is free to express her strong feelings about this as she wishes, but I don't really see a legal difference between this 3-3 resolution and, as I say, the many others that we have had before. What I think is important is that going forward, we've agreed to do a rulemaking on this, and we will be proceeding with that expeditiously. And so whatever problems we have presumably will not be encountered in the next cycle, assuming anyone takes public funds.
Very good. Other comments? Commissioner Walther?
First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Stoltz and the staff for the work they did on this. That was a very difficult time for all of us. Over quite a period of time, and it was a tough debate and a lot of hard discussions, and throughout all of that, you were very professional, very helpful to bring us through this, and so my hat is off to you and your staff for the hard work you did. This was a very difficult thing for us. The numbers were high. The stakes were high. We felt very strongly about our legal views, and as Commissioner Mason said, we have a very debatable issue, although in our separate minds I think we see it not so much as debatable but quite clear. But nevertheless, each side had some strong arguments to make. I fell down on the side of the really concluded that there was no regulatory basis at this point to support that kind of spending in our regulations, and that the phone banks example simply was not designed to cover anything like this, and it was so said in the ENJ. And if there was any question about that, and there should have been in the minds of most really quite qualified counsel, that this deserves, if they want to spend that kind of money, some further guidance. And that was not requested of the commission in any AO of any kind. So it can be said that if it came before us, we would look at an allocation approach. And I think it needs to be said a couple things. First of all, the way the money was spent here, in my mind, was important. If you do follow the money, it was all spent in the battleground states. It was not spent nationwide. It was spent in very precisely in those states where the presidential race was hotly contested. So certainly, to me, the benefit to be received was principally the presidential candidate. So any allocation on that basis alone would have been far in excess of 50%. Would it have been 100%? Hard to say, but in any event, it would be hard to conclude that it could be anything but much, much more than, overwhelmingly more than 50%. I also think that when you have a presidential race, granted there's coattails and other candidates that can benefit from an association with a campaign with the president, but on the other hand, the president is taking public money, and I think it should be spent principally for issues relating to the election or defeat of presidential candidates. And that responsibility, I think, is one that should be in the uppermost in the minds of the presidential candidates who take that money. Whether we'll see that in the future with the public funding certainly remains to be seen, as all of us know. So, yes, it was a very difficult decision for all of us. But we voted it out. And one of the compromises that came with it, of course, was that we would vote it out and discuss this publicly. So you see the footnote in the audit, and typically that is not necessarily the procedure that would be followed, although this is my first experience with the presidential audit. But historically, if there's a deadlock on an issue, it doesn't rise to the surface of a footnote. It does not get into the audit. And here part of our compromise was, yes, we have a very serious disagreement on this issue, but it must go public so that everybody can have an understanding of our respective positions, have a healthy public debate, consider what's the best course of action, and it certainly will help militate us toward a solution when we get to the regulatory process in the very near future. So our positions are pretty well stated in our respective written statements that were filed either last night or this morning. And I think our legal analysis is covered in a little more detail on those for those that are interested.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Walther. Other comments? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
There was no broken bargain. There was no violation of the law. Now, I respect my colleagues' different opinion about this, but the very fact that we had a debate on a very difficult issue of the law and disagreed make it very clear that it would be completely unfair to say that the campaign violated the law when we disagree whether there was a violation. What did the campaign rely on? Well, they relied on two different regulations that we have, the audit from 2000 and an AO in 2004, in all of which we made clear that when you do an expenditure, when you do a phone bank, when you do an ad that has benefits to a clearly identified federal candidate, there's a generic reference to other candidates, then we will allow an allocation of the costs of that between the party and the candidate. Now, I'm not going to go over all of each of these. These are outlined in our statements. But I would point out that, you know, this agency approved an audit out of the 2000 election of the Bush-Cheney campaign, and that included a phone bank get-out-the-vote effort in which a message was sent to voters saying, vote for George Bush and the great Republican team. I mean, that's very similar to the kind of ads that were run in 04, and whether you're using that script in a phone bank or in a TV ad, the effect is the same. Now, in that particular case, the campaign paid 25% of the costs, and the state parties paid 75%. And our audit department and our Office of General Counsel recommended that it be 50-50. Now, I wasn't on the commission at the time. The commission was unable to agree on that, and so the fact that they had split 25-75 was okay, and the audit was approved. In the 04 campaign, they played it safe, and they, instead of only paying 25% of the cost, they paid 50%. And they had good reason for doing that, given the phone bank regulations that we had put on. So they were relying on prior precedent, prior AOs, and their experience with this commission. So I think they, any good lawyer would say they had a very reasonable basis for the action that they did. And I would point out, this is a matter of public knowledge, that the Kerry campaign did exactly the same thing with the DNC. They also put out hybrid ads just like this. And I also don't believe that they violated the law, because they also were relying on the precedent that's outlined here. I understand my colleagues disagree, but that's the point. You know, the fact that we as six commissioners have a different interpretation of the statute and the regulations here make it clear that it would be unfair to say that the campaign violated the law, because there's no finding that they did so. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you. Get a little bit of flavor here. This was a matter that was debated extensively here at the commission for a period of time. And I think that there are a number of written statements that are obviously available outside that I think clearly set forth the thinking and the arguments that transpired here. And I think those are helpful documents to get a grasp on the positions that the people argued. My view of that is detailed in a statement that Commissioner Weintraub and Commissioner Walther have signed on to, and is as I said, is available outside. My views did not prevail, and having reached that point, I concluded that the best thing to do is to vote to approve the document that is presented to us today by our auditors, and to, as a consequence, bring this matter to a close. So that is my sense of how I will proceed on all of this. Other thoughts or comments? Vice Chairman Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move approval of the report of the Audit Division on Bush-Cheney 04, Inc. and Bush-Cheney 04 Compliance Committee as set forth in Agenda Document 07-22.
Very good. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Madam Secretary, if you could record the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-1 with Commissioner Weintraub dissenting. Thank you very much. Again, a number of us said it. I'd like to close out with a real expression of thanks to our auditors and to our lawyers. This was, in fact, an enormous amount of work and hard work at that, and we appreciate your efforts. Thank you. Okay, the last item on our agenda is management and administrative matters. Ms. Masonette, are there any management or administrative matters for us to address today?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is one as follow-up to the open session on March 8th, where we received a demonstration of the Commission's new advisory opinion search system. We are offering training. I'm pleased to tell the Commission that the first session scheduled for the morning of April 11th is full, but we do have room at the 1 o'clock session, and anybody who's interested can register either on our website or sending an email to conferences@fec.gov. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. I know that I've gotten some comments from outside of appreciation for the improvements to the to that system, and our folks in the tech section, our folks in the legal department really deserve our appreciation for doing that. With that, I bring to a close the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, March 22nd. Thank you very much.